This is the Tuesday, October 26, 2010 edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Last June, a flash flood along the Little Missouri River swept through a remote portion of the Albert Pike Recreational Area on the Ouachita National Forest, about 6 miles north of Langley. 20 campers were killed in that flood. As the waters receded, top USDA Forest Service officials toured the disaster site. The agency has issued an inquiry. It released its findings late last week, as well as a nationwide action plan to prevent this from ever happening again. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
The Little Missouri River, which cuts through the rugged Ouachita mountain range in Montgomery County east of Hot Springs, is designated a wild and scenic river. The popular recreation sites operated by the USDA Forest Service. The watershed has a long history of documented flood events dating back to 1940, but the Forest Service reports that the June 11th storm exceeded any other, transforming a placid 4-foot-deep stream into a 23-foot-tall torrent at 3 a.m. in the morning while most campers slept. Tents, recreational vehicles, even automobiles were swept downstream. 20 people died. That's why the USDA Forest Service is taking measures nationwide to prevent this type of disaster happening elsewhere. Jim Pena is Associate Deputy Chief for the National Forest System.
Yeah, the Recreation Safety Report was initiated as a result of the Albert Pike disaster. It was a tragedy. And I think the thing that we leveraged from that was having each of the regions across the country go back and look at, do a rapid assessment of what kind of things do we have in place relative to visitor safety. And the results of that rapid assessment is what we built on to create the Recreation Visitor Report.
After U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and USDA Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell toured the flood-devastated Albert Pike Campground last June, Vilsack called for an inquiry. And the Forest Service ordered a rapid assessment of developed Forest Service recreation sites nationwide.
We will have an action plan at the national level completed by November 30th, from which we'll begin to work on those national level items.
As a consequence, forest managers are focused on 6 national actions.
Accountability, oversight, and monitoring. And one of the things that this report really daylighted for us is, we're working on our national level, creating a new safety culture for the agency. And what this did was really emphasize the fact that we need to look outside the agency as much as inside, because we've been focused on employee safety. And so this provided an opportunity for us to build in public safety as a significant part of that national safety effort, and so we'll be working on that. And then just making sure that we follow up on and have systems in place to follow up on to make sure that national direction is being followed and implemented.
Policies and procedures will also identify areas for review with regard to visitor safety and agency communications.
Effective internal communication to provide for visitor safety is a primary purpose for our communication system. In some areas, the radio system in particular, there is a perception that it's a single focus purpose. So like where we have a lot of fire activity, it's viewed as, it's a fire dispatch center. But what we want to be able to communicate as we upgrade and plan for upgrading our system is that it is a system that needs to support all activities on the national forest.
Improved training for Forest Service employees and volunteers relative to visitor safety is also being planned, as well as ongoing intra-agency emergency response. But outdoor recreational activities on national forest system lands, including recreation sites, have inherent risks, Jim Pena says, so visitors must be vigilant.
The recreation that we provide is generally provides the visitor with more of an opportunity to be independent. We have a lot of open space. We have a lot of access. And so, it's not like they're checking in at an entry station like in the Park Service and they get contacted every time people go in. And so what we have relied on and have encouraged the public to do is to be aware of the area they're going to, what kind of environmental and experience that they could expect, and to check ahead on the weather. The Forest Service doesn't forecast weather. We rely on the Weather Service to do that, and so we rely on the visitor to be knowledgeable and to look ahead and be prepared for the conditions that that they're expected to encounter. And so it's kind of a tough thing in these times where maybe the types of visitors that are visiting the National Forest now aren't as self-reliant or as experienced in visiting the outdoors as maybe they were 20, 30, 100 years ago when the National Forest System was first established. And so that's a piece of what we need to do in looking at our policies and see, what else might we need to do to make sure that visitors to the National Forest have a safe and enjoyable experience.
And most of all, the Albert Pike disaster is forcing the Forest Service to examine its processes and procedures.
What are our processes and procedures in place that we have in place or that we need to put in place to better evaluate how unique or unusual hazards such as flash flooding, flooding, other geologic hazards like rock falls, those kind of things, need to be incorporated into site development and planning for developed recreation sites.
The need for this was made clear in a companion 70-page long USDA report detailing the Albert Pike Recreation Area disaster. The campgrounds comprised of four loops. Loop D, which was inundated, was constructed in 2003 along a known 100-year floodplain. According to Project Files, a soil scientist assessing it advised constructing only primitive campsites and posting flood hazard signs. The report also reveals the site's hydrologist admitted he failed to follow authorized floodplain elevation measurement protocol. In the end, no signs were posted, and electrical and water hookups for recreational vehicles were installed along Loop D. Still, in its report, the Forest Service did say that despite failings to implement adequate safety measures, including posting warning signs, it's unclear whether anything could have been done to prevent loss of life in the early morning hours of June 11th. The U.S. Geological Survey reported the event exceeded even a 500-year flood, confounding all planning and emergency capabilities. The Forest Service, in its report, commended first responders for their valiant and effective effort in the face of treacherous conditions last summer. Albert Pike Campground Loops C and D remain closed until further notice. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. October is American Archives Month. This will be noted tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock inside Mullins Library on the University of Arkansas campus. Keynote speakers for this event devoted to history will be a pair of teenage historians. Sarah and Emma Balin attend Central High in Little Rock and have been making short documentaries since they were 11 years old. Tomorrow afternoon, they'll screen their film Return to Sender about the 1980 Cuban refugee crisis at Fort Chaffee and how that event changed Arkansas's political landscape. We recently invited Tom Dillard, the head of special collections at the University of Arkansas, to come to our studio to talk about archives, about tomorrow's program, and about the future of history.
Archives have an important role to play in a democracy. It's important in a democracy that we have awareness of our national identity. And you really can't have that unless you preserve the records that establish that national identity. And, of course, here in Arkansas, we have our own archival interest in preserving the history of the state of Arkansas and the community of Fayetteville and so on.
Archives can tell us about legislators, can tell us about policymakers, newsmakers, but archives can tell us all those things in between the things we already know.
Yes. For a long, long time, historians had the tendency to record what was called the history of the great men of our past. The great man interpretation of history is now relegated to the trash bin, and historians now realize that we need to look at the entirety of the American experience and not just selected parts of it. So archives are very important, in my opinion, to reinforcing our democratic impulse and occasionally perhaps reminding us that we need to stop and take a deep breath. I'm reminded of that in particular in relationship to the concerns that many people have right now on immigration. But if you look back through our history, you'll see that this battle that we're fighting now is in many ways a repetition of prior aspects of American history.
Special Collections is in the business of archiving history, right?
The Special Collections Department of the University of Arkansas Libraries has the mission of preserving the history of Arkansas and the region. And by doing that, we collect over a wide range. We collect manuscripts, we collect books, we collect magazines, we collect maps. We have a very nice, large historical map collection. Photographs. Photographs are very important for documenting our past, and the University of Arkansas Special Collections Department has a large collection of photographs, mostly from here in Arkansas. So, yes, we collect at the U of A libraries. We document Arkansas. We try to document Arkansas in its entirety, not just history, too, but geography and geology, the natural heritage of our state, all kinds of activities. We try to, each year we try to collect those things which we think might have been overlooked in the past and that would add depth and variety to our collections. Just today, as a matter of fact, I received through an email news about five letters we're getting out of Illinois, and it's includes this 1827 letter. And if I could have just a minute, I'd love to quote from it.
You bet.
This is an 1827 letter written from Dwight Mission in Arkansas, which is down near Russellville. It was a school and mission for the Cherokee Indians, and this letter is being written by a gentleman named Samuel Newton, back to his family in New Jersey. And he says, "I say what a pity that such beautiful young ladies," and he's referring here to members of his own class in the North, but also in the South, too, and in frontier Arkansas. "Such beautiful ladies, formed such by nature, should have their minds neglected. It is not enough that young ladies can card, spin, and weave, and milk the cows, and dress, and cook the food. They should be made to feel mental refinement and taste of the sweets of a common education, if not of the sweets of a refined one. Neither should young ladies who have been blessed with schools, they should not drop their pens and throw away their books when they graduate. They should continue their studies, use their pens, and improve their minds. One of the dark shades of heathenism is the oppression of women." Now, isn't that an interesting commentary from 1827, Frontier, Arkansas? That's an example of a manuscript, a letter, an unpublished letter. A lot of folks are puzzled when we use the term manuscripts. What exactly is a manuscript? And a manuscript is an eyewitness account, usually not published, but rather often in a letter, handwritten, or nowadays done on a computer, of course. But primary sources, meaning eyewitness events, which have not been published, those kinds of manuscripts are the undergirding for the history that is recorded by historians.
When you receive email notification that a letter such as this is coming to you, you had no idea this letter existed, or did you?
We had no idea that these five letters that make up this package, we had no idea that it existed. An individual whose family has had these letters for a long, long time got in touch with us because they did some experimenting, some investigation on the Internet, looking for a good home for these letters. Mm-hmm. And since they're written from Arkansas, it only made sense, of course, that they be donated to an Arkansas institution. And we're very pleased and honored that they chose us.
There will be a couple of speakers this year for this Observation of Archives Month. A couple of young women who... What, not yet 20, right? They're in high school? Is that right?
Oh, I think they're more like 16 or 17.
My goodness.
These are the Balin twins out of Little Rock, and I first met them about 2 years ago when they were even younger than they are now. They're now students at Central High School in Little Rock. Sarah and Emma Balin decided as elementary students that they wanted to make videos, that they wanted to be filmmakers. And so these gifted children set up their own little company called Double Troublets, and they started making films. And so in order to do the research to base their films on, they had to visit archival institutions and other sources of information. And so they came, among other places, they came to the University of Arkansas Special Collections Department. Very serious students. They did research in original sources. They were at the University of Arkansas doing work on the 1980 Cuban boat lift, which had a large impact on Arkansas in 1980 because many of them were sent to Fort Chaffee, and that played a role in the 1980 gubernatorial contest in which Bill Clinton was put out of office after his first term. So the Cuban boat lift is an important aspect of Arkansas history, and that's where I first met them, was when they were doing research on that film. And they're going to show this film at our Archives Month event on October the 27th. The Balin twins are really an impressive couple of young Arkansans who are doing remarkable work at such a young age. We'll also be reporting to the people who come to the open house about our work over the last year and what we've been able to bring in the way of manuscripts and books and maps and all sorts of things.
If Sarah or Emily Balin follows you, and 30 years from now they are the head of Special Collections, are they going to be archiving tweets and goodness knows what?
This question of electronic life that we're in right now, and how does one document this dramatic transformation in America to the digital age? How do we document that? And that question is and has been having a profound impact on the archival community and the whole library community. Vast change is on its way. And I think, you know, in the archival community, yes, we're going to be forced to deal with these electronic resources. And we're going to be forced to change our way of thinking. I expect that over time we will have many, many fewer print materials to archive. It concerns me greatly, and it concerns all archivists. Emails are, as a general rule, not preserved. And it's going to, I think, cause archivists to have to think very innovatively in order to capture our history in the future.
47 years ago is about all you could get in 140 characters, right? The rest would have been in the ether.
That's right. But, you know, I don't know of anything to collect that would be more important in documenting the social change that's going on and economic change and all kinds of change that's going on right now because of the electronic revolution. The transition to the digital world is going to have manifestations for archivists and historians for a long time to come.
October 27th, 3 to 5 at Mullins, room 130. But if you go into Mullins Library, there will be signs directing you.
That's right. And we invite people to give us a call at the Special Collections, and we'll give some advice on parking and that sort of thing.
And if someone finds that letter from 1827 in the attic and they don't know what to do?
Give us a call. Special Collections is always eager to collect both the pre-digital and the post-digital.
Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tom Dillard is the head of Special Collections at the University of Arkansas's Mullins Library. The department's observance of American Archives Month is tomorrow afternoon. Reception at 3, program at 3:30 in room 130 of Mullins Library. If you'd like more information, libinfo.uark.edu. And again, if you want to know more about links associated with the stories you hear on our program, you can go to our webpage, OzarksAtLarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The 2010 midterm elections are approaching ever so quickly, and many people are talking about the Tea Party and what it may mean in this election. It's not the first time a third party has gathered some attention. Here to talk with us about third parties through history, our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So the Tea Party, they are certainly an interesting political development to watch.
And I think development might be a good word to use there. They like to call themselves a party, but it's a loosely associated group of voters, really, congealing around two or three issues. Third-party politics have almost always been issue-oriented. Although there are a few notable exceptions where personality would drive the groups, especially in the 20th century. Theodore Roosevelt comes to mind with his presidential run, the Bull Moose Party. Ross Perot, where it was Perot and then they invented a party to go with him. John Anderson, of a name from the past, often overlooked in 1980. And the Kingfish himself, Huey Long, with his share the wealth scheme during the 1930s. But, you know, those four exceptions, it almost always is a group of issues that get people motivated.
You say issue-oriented. What sort of issues often bring a third party to the fore?
Well, sometimes the issue is one that can launch a party, a true party. Certainly, that's what happened with the death of the Whigs in the mid-19th century, which eventually gave rise to the Republicans. Remember, Abraham Lincoln was only the second Republican presidential candidate and a bit of a third-party president because it was abolition, the single issue that really motivated the Republicans at that time, and they were able to eventually congeal that into one of our two major parties today.
So does that mean what we're seeing now in 2010 is the birth of a new party?
I doubt it. The reality is that this is an issue movement. And we've certainly seen our share of those. They lack the organization to actually launch a presidential candidate and to really last as a cohesive unit.
So then who would you compare historically the Tea Party or this Tea Party movement to? The Founding Fathers?
Well, the original individuals that fostered the Tea Party were, of course, the Sons of Liberty, well-to-do New Englanders who were opposed to the taxations and other restrictions that had been visited upon the colonies. In late 1773, Samuel Adams, not to be confused with beer of the same name, and others came together to plan this act of disobedience in Boston. In the sense that these were part of a growing resistance to the British crown, yeah, you could say the Tea Parties are similar from colonial times and now, but it's not a really apt comparison.
Is there an apt comparison?
Well, I think the populists give us a better analog at the end of the 19th century because they might show us where the Tea Party could go if they can stay together. Remember, the populist platform took advantage of some serious economic upheaval in 1893 and 1894, and they combined in a way with the standing Republican Party to have a big impact on the 1894 midterms. But by 1896 and the presidential election, many of the issues, most important being silver coinage and money issues, had been co-opted by the Democrats. So the populists tended to have ideas that became part of other movements and they themselves were the outgrowth of the Grange and other social political movements that had gone before him. It was sort of a cycle in which the populists were the name to this group that had an issue. Now, they did manage in 1892 to pick up 22 electoral votes for their candidate, James Weaver, but they were really more about the issues than about the politics. Right now, though, in many ways, if you just had to take a single snapshot of today, the Tea Party most resemble another 19th century movement, the Mugwumps.
The Mugwumps. M-U-G-W-U-M-P-S, the Mugwumps.
Yes, indeed, and you look somewhat puzzled by the Mugwumps. They were a significant number of Republicans during the corruption of the Gilded Age era that bolted from the party to support the reform candidate of the Democrats, Grover Cleveland. They got the name Mugwump, referring to an Algonquin Indian word for important person or kingpin. But cynical newspapermen quickly twisted that into sanctimonious or holier than thou for the way that they had abandoned their party over principle. It's that moralistic tone and the fact that with them behind Cleveland, he was able to win the White House in 1884 that also lead the term mugwump in politics to refer to a disloyal political splinter group.
Well, last time I checked, the yard signs in my neighborhood, there was no one who said vote mugwump, vote reform, vote bull moose. What does it take for a new movement, a new party? What's next for the Tea Party?
Well, you know, I think November's results are the key. You know, will they really have the impact that they are being advertised to have? And once they've had that impact, will they stick together and form themselves? Will they be simply reabsorbed by the GOP? Not unlike the Students for Democratic Society blossomed on the far left wing of the Democratic Party in the 60s. And once their issues were either addressed or time had removed those issues, they drifted back into the Democratic Party. The Goldwater Republicans, who came and went in essentially a single election cycle during the 1964 campaign? Or will they take over the host organism like we saw with the Reagan Revolution in the 1980s as they toppled the East Coast-oriented Rockefeller wing of the GOP at that time? Either way, it doesn't seem terribly likely that the Tea Party continues on to the presidential cycle 2 years from now. I'm going to take an educated guess and say they seem more inclined to follow the path of the populists, who have their best ideas absorbed by the party they came from, the populists to the Democrats, and in this case, the T to the GOP.
Wouldn't some third party people over the course of history say that's okay if we made enough of an impact to change the discussion or change a major party stance or make them a certain way? Part of the goal there has been accomplished?
You're right. And that is one of the things about the American system, particularly the Electoral College winner-take-all system, that in a presidential cycle almost reinforces two parties. The question becomes, do you take over a party from within, or do you break out to the outside? Again, 1860s with the Republicans and Lincoln, they had to actually break away. They still needed the help of the remnants of the dying parties to support them in their electoral bid. But that's the thing about the way our presidential cycle works that really keeps us into the two channels. Whether or not the Tea Party can brew up enough discontent to become the permanent other party, who knows?
So change can happen. It's just rare.
That's right.
And until that next change,
we're history.
Bill Smith earned his master's and his PhD in history at the University of Arkansas and teaches history at Northwest Arkansas Community College. And a week from today, Election Day, Bill will be back to give us a quiz about many past third parties in American history.
Is it a party quiz? I'll give you the name and you'll tell me yes or no. Is that a real American third party?
So did this third party actually exist at some point in American history?
Right.
Our history doctor with a third party quiz on Election Day a week from today here on Ozarks at Large. looking ahead to the next few days in the KUAF listening area, a free astronomy night at Withrow Springs State Park is scheduled for Saturday night at Withrow Springs State Park. It will begin at dusk. You'll be able to join Northwest Arkansas Astronomical Society members for guided viewing using telescopes, binoculars, even your naked eye. You should bring your own lawn chair and be prepared for Ozark nighttime temperatures. For more information, 559-2593. The Bella Vista Village Property Owners Association will begin collecting non-perishable food items Monday for Thanksgiving gift baskets for local families in need. Items will be collected through November 17th. The baskets will be delivered the week of Thanksgiving to Bella Vista families. Drop-off sites are established at Reardon Hall and at the Branchwood Recreation Center. For more information, 855-8170. And the University of Arkansas Fort Smith will bring the touring production of Fiddler on the Roof to Fort Smith a week from tonight. That's November 2nd at 7:30 in the Arkansas Best Corporation Performing Arts Center at the Fort Smith Convention Center. For cost, tickets, or more information, you can go online to uafortsmith.edu. The Fayetteville Farmers Market heads into the home stretch of autumn. That and more still ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
Mahalia Jackson, known as the Queen of Gospel Singing, was born on this date in 1911 in New Orleans, Louisiana. Jackson became a leading singer in gospel music, known for her rich, powerful voice. A devout Baptist, she still found time for secular sounds of such blues artists as Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey. After moving to Chicago in the late 1920s, Jackson joined the Greater Salem Baptist Church and soon became a member of the Johnson Gospel Singers. She performed with the group for a number of years. After singing with the Johnson Gospel Singers, Jackson started working with Thomas A. Dorsey, a gospel composer. She also worked a number of jobs before her musical career took off. While she made some recordings in the 1930s, Jackson had her first taste of success with Move Up a Little Higher in 1947, which sold 1 million copies. She became more in demand, making radio and television appearances. Jackson also had a successful tour abroad in 1952 and became especially popular in France. She even had her own gospel program on the CBS television network in 1954 and scored a hit with Rusty Old Halo that same year. In 1958, she appeared at the Newport Jazz Festival in Rhode Island, performing with Duke Ellington and his band. Jackson became an active supporter of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. She sang at the March on Washington at the request of her friend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963. After King's death in 1968, Jackson sang at his funeral and largely withdrew from public political activities. On this date in 1852, Scottish stonemason Robert Brownlee married Annie Lamont of Little Rock. Brownlee had been 23 when he read about the December 1835 fire in New York City and the need for help in rebuilding the city. He arrived in New York in 1836, where he found work cutting stone. 4 months later, he was hired by the architect for the State House in Raleigh, North Carolina, to cut stone for the Capitol building. As the building neared completion, he learned that skilled masons were needed in Little Rock to help finish what would come to be known as the Old State House. Brownlee lived in Little Rock from 1837 to 1849, and the Brownlee House is preserved on its original site at the Historic Arkansas Museum in Little Rock at 3rd and Cumberland Streets. On this date in 1881, the gunfight at the OK Corral took place in Tombstone, Arizona, as Wyatt Earp, his two brothers, and Doc Holliday confronted Ike Clanton's gang. 3 members of Clanton's gang were killed. Earp's brothers were wounded. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It is October 26, 2010. It's a Tuesday. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Bacon-Martin, the editor of What's Up from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And I should point out, before I tell you about this first thing, that if you are looking for the Halloween stuff, Mm-hmm. It's all over What's Up.
Okay.
It was all over What's Up last weekend, and it's still all over What's Up online.
And when Halloween falls on a Sunday, that means that you can probably find trick-or-treating for 3 days. Some people do it Friday, some Saturday, some will observe Sunday.
And there's all kinds of haunted houses around here, and there's all kinds of trunk-or-treats and other events, and it's all at nwaonline.com/whatsup. Kyle's giving me the look that he doesn't know what a trunk-or-treat is.
I've never heard that before. Trunk-or-treat?
Really?
Yeah.
It's usually a church thing where church members come to the church parking lot and park their cars, they open their trunks, and that's where kids trick-or-treat.
Oh.
It's a safe way of trick-or-treating.
Okay. All right. I like it.
He learns something new every day.
You do, yes.
But today, there's a new school fall carnival from 5 to 8 o'clock at the Pauline Whitaker Arena in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. And it benefits Arkansas Children's Hospital. Admission is $20, but you get all sorts of things. 521-7037. There's a program tonight on basketry and textiles in the Ozarks at 7 o'clock at the Arkansas Archaeological Survey Building. Mm-hmm. It's the Archaeological Society meeting, and it's free.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight, Filter, the band.
Yes.
Is at George's Majestic Lounge at 9 o'clock. Apparently, they're best known for their hit single, Hey Man, Nice Shot, in 1995. I believe Kevin Kinder when he tells me these things.
And they're tonight at George's Majestic Lounge.
Tickets are $18.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. It is autumn, but that does not mean that nature's harvest has dried up or gone away for the season. With me, representing Ozarks Low Food, is Teresa Maurer. Teresa, welcome back.
Thanks, Kyle. Once again, glad to be here.
And, you know, we know that in summer and early fall, boy, you can go to a farmer's market or you can go to your garden and get a lot of things. We start to think now that it's pretty much pumpkins only, but that's not the case, right?
It's not the case. And I'm here to tell you that the Saturday market is going to continue for 4 more weeks through November 20th. And there's incredible diversity there right now. Basically, you'll be able to find everything there that you find in the summer except for the summer fruits. And, I just was amazed at what I've seen there. And so we just want to let people know, you know, the cool season, it doesn't mean things stop growing. We've actually had, you know, this nice kind of warm period, and there's wonderful diversity there. So you can actually come to the market from 7 to 2 any of the next 4 Saturdays through November 20th.
That's the Saturday Farmers Market on the Fayetteville Square.
Exactly.
This Saturday, by the way, you can come in costume because it's the day before Halloween.
You can. This is going to be really fun. At 10:30, there will be entries for a costume contest. And it will have prizes for the best costume for a kid, an adult, and or a dog. So you can enter in any or all of those categories. There's a $5 entry fee, and that's going to go for Spay Arkansas, which is a really good nonprofit to benefit from this. So Saturday will be especially fun, I think, both for you as a buyer coming for the diversity and you as a sightseer and you as a theatrical participant. You can come in costume. So 10:30. Look on Mountain Street for the place to turn in your entry.
Now, you've mentioned the Saturday markets. Sunday markets will continue, the ones that happen at the Fayetteville or at the Botanical Gardens of the Ozarks?
Actually, there's just one more
just
of
one
those,
left.
And that is on Halloween itself, October 31st, at the Botanical Gardens from 9 till 2. And that will be a customer appreciation day. And there'll be games, there'll be treats. You don't have to come in costume. There won't be a costume contest. You're always welcome to dress up. But it will not be a contest that day. But that'll be a way that particular market is, as well as the other weekday markets, which are also ending this week, can express their appreciation for customers.
So Thursday, Tuesday, this is it for the
this
season,
is
but not
it
Saturday.
This week, but not Saturday. So be sure to mark your calendar for the markets the next few weeks. It's not going away.
Now, the third annual Ozark Slow Food Fundraiser is approaching as well.
That's it, yes. And this is coming up on Sunday, November 7th. And what it's going to do is support our 2011 activities. And it's a really, I think, unique opportunity to, once again, come to a private home. This home is located near Mount Sequoia, and we're going to have a demonstration, a discussion, and a dinner provided by David Lewis of Brick House Kitchen. And it's going to get started at 5:30. And the theme is sort of thinking about local seasonal fall foods. You know, remember I just said the diversity at the market. David will give you some great ideas for how to use that. And again, eating food at their peak taste, their peak nutrition, that's something that continue into the fall. We're just so lucky here in the Ozarks that we have that kind of growing season.
Now, I know David did something similar to this either early summer or late spring at Ozark Natural Foods.
Right.
Talked people through what he was doing and what he was preparing. That sort of same approach here?
Same approach, except that you'll get a full dinner as well as the demonstration. There'll be a little bit of wine that'll come with the dinner. And it is a limited seating, but this kitchen is incredible. It's a world-class kitchen. There'll be room for everybody to see exactly what David is doing. And the difference is you'll get to sit down afterwards and have this wonderful dinner, you know, with about 30 to 35 other folks that have your interest in local food, and just have a great evening.
Knowing David as I do, I doubt you have any idea yet what ingredients he's going to use, because he always seems to be the kind of guy who goes on the fly.
Exactly. He does what you do, probably, if you go to the market. You see what's there, and he will put it together in some really fun but doable combination for you. So the big difference, I think, is the fact that it's a dinner. It is more expensive than some of our other events, which have been free or very low cost, but we don't really have a good way, except for this, to do fundraising for our next year's activities. So this is a way to vote with your dollars if you like some of the work that we do.
Well, I would hope that for a slow food fundraiser, the ticket would be more than free. It's not a very good fundraiser if it's free.
That's right. And thanks for that reminder. Tickets are $50 per person, but they are tax deductible because Ozark Slow Food is a 501c3. They will be available at the NCAT offices. That's another local nonprofit. And we're located just off the square in the Walker Stone House, which is across from the Moore Funeral Home, if you know where that is, at 207 West Center. We'll have tickets there available from 9 to 5, and you can just drop by and pick one up, and we have the directions to the home on the ticket.
If you can find the Central Fire Station in Fayetteville.
Exactly. We are right next to the fire station, between the fire station and the square, the same side of the street as the fire station.
So David Lewis will be doing this on early Sunday evening. It begins November 7th.
Exactly, at 5:30.
All right. Teresa, anything else?
That will do it today, Kyle. Thank
you. All right. Thank you. Teresa Maurer is with Ozark Slow Food. The organization's third annual fundraiser is scheduled for Sunday, November 7th. For more information, you can call 601-2900. Speaking of fundraisers, thanks again from everyone at KUAF and Ozarks at Large for making last week's fall fundraiser at KUAF the shortest in KUAF history. Thanks to you, we raised $140,000 in really under 3.5 days. Your continued support means the programs you enjoy on KUAF can continue to come to you. Thanks again from everyone at KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission yesterday dropped a proposal to create its own much more limited version of the Freedom of Information Act. Last week, a three-member panel moved forward with the proposal, prompting an outcry from the governor and attorney general, saying the proposal would be illegal. So yesterday afternoon, Game and Fish Commissioner Eamon Mahoney of El Dorado says they decided to drop that measure.
One reason would be Mike Beebe. A second reason would be Dustin McDaniel. They indicated their displeasure that we were doing it, so we decided not to do it.
Mahoney emphasizes that last week's vote for the Game and Fish Commission to create its own version of the Freedom of Information Act was only to allow further study.
That was a procedural move to get it going forward. I had intended to spend most of this month doing a little research and reading it and talking to people about it and getting ready for what I thought would be a real thorough discussion next month. Well, needless to say, it got adverse reaction to the point we dropped it.
Shortly after yesterday afternoon's vote, Governor Mike Beebe released a statement saying he was pleased to see quick action stop the effort. Last week, the governor had threatened to defund the agency if it moved forward with a proposal to keep some information from being made public. And that's just about all the time we have for this Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Walton Art Center and the 10x10 Art Series, presenting the dance troupe Trey McIntyre Project Friday, November 5th. This modern dance company will perform Trey McIntyre's latest work, Wild Sweet Love, featuring music by Queen, Lou Reed, Roberta Flack, and Felix Mendelssohn. Tickets and more information about the 10x10 Art Series now available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Poteau, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. If you'd like to hear the show again or share one of the stories you heard today on Facebook or Twitter or at any other number of online facilities, you can do that by going to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. And we'll end this Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large with music from Danielle Gasparo. The songwriter and pianist is on her Song Sweet Song tour of the U.S., or at least she will be by Friday, because it starts in Fayetteville Friday night at Good Folk on Block Street in Fayetteville. If you'd like more information about the concert, you can go to goodfolk.org. We'll listen to Danielle Gasparo's song Pale Blue, this from her CD Birdsong. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks for listening. Back tomorrow at noon with another new edition.
Take a walk out in the park to let it go. You take your thoughts into the cold, wide winter snow when you wander slow.